God, can't we get any like Lawrence Welk or, you know, Stravinsky or something?
Just how about
like,
Perry Como?
Perry Como. God, I feel like I'm a sprocket. Well, this is the Q Report. Q stands for quotidian.
As if.
As if people don't know that.
As if there is anything quotidian about this broadcast.
Well, you know, quotidian is the fabric of everyday life, and we're going to be talking about some fabric things like what we eat. This isn't just a food thing. This is a real broad brushstroke of what people should be eating, like what their diet should be. We have Sally Fallon on, and that is a huge honor because the Weston Price Foundation is as big and as important as they come.
Tell us a little more about the Weston Price Foundation.
Well, I mean, Sally is...
I'd never heard of it until you told me Sally Fallon was going to be on the show with us.
She believes that animal fats and cholesterol are not villains, but vital factors in the diet necessary for normal growth, proper function of the brain and the nervous system, protection from disease, and optimum energy levels.
Well, I can see why you would think that.
I would never optimum
being energy. Being a meat dealer.
Well, I always wonder about Sally. Like, I've never met her or seen her, but I wonder if she is just like Wonder Woman.
Is she optimally just, like, healthful?
Yeah, like she would be like, drop down and give me 50, and like I couldn't do all 50, and she would be doing like 100, and then we'd go to the push-ups, and then we'd go like on some obstacle course, and she would just be, you know...
She'd be miles ahead of you.
Yeah, I mean, it could be.
You'd be eating her dust.
I would be. Well, I don't know.
In spite of the fact that you eat animal proteins.
I eat a lot of fat, so maybe I'm going to win. So we have Sally Fallon on, and of course, Sally is working, you know, on the prison soy lawsuit, which, you know, for, you know, is as much as it might not affect all of our listeners, you know, in a lot of ways it does, because it's about big companies forcing their way, almost like as if, you know, using humans as lab rats to see if their science food can substitute for, you know, multi-nutritional, you know, varied diet. And obviously it's not working in this Illinois prison.
Is it just the one prison, or is it, you know, prisons? Prisons are often privately owned now. They're not, they're sort of independent businesses. So is this just one prison that's feeding its inmates soy isolates? And let's get...
Do I look like Sally Fallon?
Let's, yeah,
are you
right.
I
got a lot
like
of questions
girl?
For Sally,
yeah,
Fallon.
Maybe hold
I got to say,
Sally.
I got a lot. I got
and
a
then,
lot of questions.
And then we're going to come after Sally, and actually he's in the studio already. We're kind of psyched to have him here. Is Ethan Gelber, and he's going to be talking to us about basically transportation, you know, environmental
talk about
tourism,
quotidian.
Bike About Inc., local, you know,
well, all the name of your company Ethan is with WHL.org. So if you go to the WHL.org website, sorry. .travel, sorry, WHL.travel.
Oh, he's created his own...
You can learn more about Ethan Gelber's eco-friendly bicycle tours, and I'm excited to hear about that, right? Yeah.
But the first guest is going to be Miss Sally Fallon.
And she's on the line, Patrick.
Oh, is that Jack Inslee, our producer?
Yes, it is.
How are you coming on and talking all like that? Did you just get the producer mic?
No, magic.
Wow, the producer Mike is at Heritage. We sound a lot more professional. And
he's actually
Sally
speaking
Fallon,
inside your head.
Welcome to the Heritage Radio Network. We're so honored.
Thank you for having me. I'm pleased to be here.
Where are you right now?
I'm in Washington, D.C., land of the diet dictocrats.
Oh, my God. We just had Ann Cooper on the last show.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you work with Ann at all, but she's been working to change some of the school lunch
very
programs.
Active in the school
I see.
Systems.
Uh-huh.
She was talking about, well, you are, I mean, tell us, I mean, we always like to talk about the grammar of how people are, who they are, and what they do. I mean, tell us a little bit about how you came to the Weston A. Price Foundation, or came to found the Weston A. Price Foundation.
Well, I wear two hats, and first I wrote the book Nourishing Traditions with Mary Enig, and she and I were very concerned about the misinformation that the government and other organizations were putting out about nutrition, particularly this low-fat agenda. And we were very concerned about what that did to growing children.
So, when was this agenda being pushed?
Well, all through the 70s and 80s and 90s, it got more and more shrill. It got enshrined as national policy in the 80s. And then in the 90s, it was made part of the doctor's protocol. At the age of two, mothers are told to put their babies on low-fat diets. This is unscientific. It's cruel. It leads to all sorts of health problems in the children when they're growing. So we decided that in addition to nourishing traditions, we needed an organization that kept track of the science, that could comment on these various studies and the propaganda that went with them, and to keep both laymen and the public and the professionals up to date on what's going on in nutrition research. So that's why we founded the Weston A. Price Foundation. That was in 1999. We publish a journal. We have a yearly conference and a huge website that's been very helpful to many thousands of people.
What was wrong with their agenda? Like, what rules of diet did it violate?
The number one problem is the very unscientific demonization of saturated fats.
Which are, give us some example for our listeners who don't know.
Okay, saturated fats include butter, coconut oil, the fats in meats, the fats in pork, meat fats and butter, and the fats in whole milk, fats in cheese. And these have been called the cause of heart disease, which is absolutely untrue. There is no relationship between how much saturated fat you eat and whether you're going to get heart disease or cancer. In fact, these fats are protective against these diseases. And what happens when they demonize the saturated fats is people start using the fake manufactured fats, vegetable oils, margarines, and spreads. And they are led to a lot of processed foods that contain these types of fats.
Now, even in large doses, are these things okay? Or, I mean,
Yeah, sure. I just take, for example, the fat on your meat. It's about 50% saturated. It's about 45% monounsaturated. And then there's about 5% of all the omega-3s and 6s, long and short chain, all in the right proportions. And when they're used with the saturated fats, they're used properly in the body. So we never put a lid or any kind of strictures on saturated fat, because your body will tell you when you've eaten enough. Now, the problem is when you deny yourself the saturated fat, because the body needs it so badly for every function, for every cell membrane, for hormone production, for immunity, then your body goes for the next best thing, which is carbohydrates, and your body very efficiently turns carbohydrates into saturated fats. The problem is that the carbohydrates don't contain the vitamins that we'd get from the animal fats, and we don't have that satiety mechanism for carbohydrates that we do for the fats.
Very
so you're
interesting.
Saying that that Dr. Atkins had it right, in a way.
In a way he did, but Dr. Atkins missed a really important part of all this equation, and that's those vitamins in the animal fats. And we call them fat-soluble activators. They're vitamins A, D, and K2. And these were extremely high in traditional diets. They're the vitamins that ensure all the minerals are used, that you get good bone structure, that the organs are formed properly, that the brain works properly. And to get these back in our diet, we need to put our animals back on grass, in the sunlight on grass. And we need to learn to eat the more nutrient-dense parts like the liver, the marrow, and the organ meats. We need to emphasize the yolks rather than the whites, the cream and butter rather than the skim milk.
Well, tell us who this, I mean, he's been called the Charles Darwin of nutrition.
Right.
Tell us, who is this Weston Price, and who did he study? I mean, about this K2, I mean, give us a little bit of history.
And how come the American protein industry, like the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, how come they're not all plugged into this and promoting the bejesus out of it?
The grass-feeding groups are plugged into this in a sense, but I'm very concerned that they're still promoting grass-fed beef as good because it's lean. The advantages of grass-feeding are in the fat. And to get the advantages, you need to eat the fat, and there needs to be enough fat on the animal to make the lean meat, the meat taste good. So Weston Price was a dentist. He worked in the 30s and 40s. He spent 10 years traveling around the world looking at healthy populations. He looked at their teeth, first of all, and then he looked at their overall health. And he found 14 population groups that had no cavities.
Where was he?
He was from Cleveland.
No, but I'm saying, where did he go?
He went to Switzerland, off the coast of Scotland, islands there. He went to Africa. He went to the South Seas and to Australia and New Zealand.
But a lot of those populations are agrarian, primarily, not meat eaters. Like the African population doesn't eat a lot of meat.
Right, that is correct. Let me just say that the underlying characteristic was not the amount of fat that they ate. Some groups had very high amounts of fat. Some groups didn't have a lot of fat, and so they had to use the carbohydrates. But the thing that was the same in all these groups was very high levels of vitamins A, D, and K2, which at that time he called Activator X because he didn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm. And what is K2?
It is the animal form of vitamin K. It is needed for facial structure. It's needed for healthy bones and teeth. If you have vitamin K2 in your saliva, you don't get cavities. It's needed for neurological function. It can be used to treat seizures, for example. And it's found in the fats of animals that are eating green grass because they transform the K1 into the K2. So you were asking about... So anyway, the underlying characteristic was very high levels. Now, in Africa, which is in many cases more of a plant-based diet, they ate... The animal foods they did eat were extremely concentrated. It would be things like insects or little dried fish or shrimp paste or organ meats or frogs or whatever. And these are not foods that that Westerners take to very easily, but they're extremely high in these three vitamins. Now, in the Western world, we have traditionally gotten these from butter and egg yolks, from eating organ meats, that sort of thing. So, you know, we like to say to people, you need to eat the foods you like, first of all, in a way that you like them. And so that might be different for someone in Africa compared to someone in the West.
I believe it. Well, I mean, give us just, you know, I don't want to spend the rest of the time with you talking about this, but I mean, as a case in point, when you remove these things, these natural things, I mean, Carlo Petrini, slow food, but anyone smart, I think, just says a varied diet, a little bit of everything, right? Yeah. You don't prohibit everything. I mean, when you do truly, I mean, as a case study, as a, what do they call it, a focus experiment, I mean, this prison soy lawsuit is an example. I mean, when you remove all these natural things and concentrate on one, this is the guinea pig effect. And tell us what has happened in that.
Well, first tell us about the prison. And is this one prison that has adopted a diet that is different from other prisons? Or is this the first of many lawsuits that the population can
expect? Well, I hope it's our only lawsuit. We have been the main organization warning the public about the dangers of modern processed soy foods or any soy foods consumed in large amounts. And because we have this information on our website, some inmates had their families do some searching on the website to find out why they were all so sick. In 2003, when Blagojevich became governor of Illinois, they stopped serving beef in the prisons, and the only meat that they started to get was chicken byproducts mixed with 60 to 70% soy protein. The macaroni and cheese was no longer cheese. It was soy nuggets, and they were adding a lot of it to the baked goods as well. So it was very hard to avoid. And all of a sudden, the inmates began to have horrible digestive problems, pains upon eating, vomiting, horrible constipation, and then thyroid problems, you know, low energy, cold all the time, weight gain, and so forth, brain fog, depression. So we started to get letters from these. First it was just one prison. Now we've heard from most of the prisons in Illinois. And we're starting to hear from prisons and prisoners in other states like Pennsylvania and New York, where they're doing the same thing. The ostensible reason is to save money and give these inmates, quote unquote, a healthier diet. The irony is that before this happened, they got a lot of organ meats in their diet. They got the cheap cuts of meat in their hamburger patties and so forth. And I've had many of them tell me, we did just fine on this diet before the soy came along. Anyway, we have filed a lawsuit on behalf of eight of the plaintiffs in the Illinois court. It's working through the whole system now. Our main goal is to get a permanent injunction against serving the soy. And if we can achieve this, then we hope that other states will realize what a terrible liability it is. Because, you know, if we win this, the personal injury lawyers will be right there. You know, because going after compensation for the health problems that these people have had.
Mm-hmm. Sally, let me ask you this. There are many millions of Americans who believe that eating soy products is probably good for you. And certainly I myself, though I don't love tofu, mm-hmm. I occasionally eat it. Mm-hmm. How can you explain that so many millions of Asian people have been living on soy-based products for centuries and they haven't really had these problems? Is there something specific about the products that are being fed to these inmates that is different from, say, the tofu that is being consumed in Japan and all over Asia mm-hmm. right now? Can you differentiate between that?
First of all, you can differentiate, but it is a myth that Asians have been living on soy foods for all these years.
It's a percentage of their diet, but a small
right.
one.
Right. It was about 1-2% of the diet. Usually it is prepared in a way that minimizes the toxins, and it's eaten in small amounts in the context of the Asian diet, which is very rich in iodine and also in vitamin A. And both of these nutrients are very critical for thyroid function. So typically in Japan, you'd have 2 or 3, maybe 4 little squares of tofu in a fish broth. And that's a really wise way to eat tofu because the fish broth will compensate for the anti-thyroid factors in the uh-huh. tofu. Now, this is in the past. The Asians are starting to eat more soy, and not because it was traditional, but because there's American companies in there promoting it. The modern soy products are not processed. They're not fermented the way the traditional ones were. They are processed in big factories, which slightly minimizes the toxins but adds a lot more. And this is our main target, is the soy protein isolate, the soy, all these fabricated soy protein types of stuff.
So in other words, like when you're eating like tofu-y ice cream, would you consider that like a soy isolate that could potentially be bad for you?
I don't know how the tofu-y is made. Tofu is made by a process that does take out some of the toxins.
What are the toxins exactly?
The toxins are, number one, phytic acid, which blocks minerals. What makes it so hard to digest are enzyme inhibitors that make your pancreas have to work really hard to digest the protein.
I believe it.
There are a lot of tannins and hemagglutinins.
Well, you're a meat dealer, man.
I don't care. I mean, first of all, I like this either way because, you know, there are so few people fighting Sally's fight, you know, against these big companies.
Look,
but I don't want to fall into, like, that's why the Democrats always had trouble getting elected in the past because they were so, I just say, the hell with them. Those big companies forcing their science food onto prisoners in schools, yeah. The hell with them.
I want to know exactly what that science food is.
Okay. Well, just, and finally, the last one are the isoflavones, which are the estrogen-like substances.
That's what I've heard is bad. But so many women are told to drink like soy milk to ward off hot flashes.
It's scandalous.
Tell us about the soy alert then. Yeah. I mean,
We have all this research on our website. It's westonaprice.org. We have a section called Soy Alert. We have loads and loads of references there. We do an update every quarter in our journal. So there's lots of information there for you. We were actually able to stop a soy health claim. A company called Sole wanted to be able to say on their products that soy prevented cancer. And we were able to show all of these studies that soy could exacerbate cancer, especially breast cancer. And they actually withdrew their petition for the claim.
Lots of breast cancers are estrogen-based. So if you have a product that feeds your estrogen level, for instance, me.
And do you want to be giving a lot of estrogen to your children? Do you want to be giving soy formula with full of estrogen and like birth control pills to your baby boys?
No.
Yeah, and this is what's happening. And unfortunately, the Hispanic population and the African American population are real targets because in the WIC program that provides free formula, they are told, they're lactose intolerant, and they're just automatically given soy formula.
Oh, interesting.
Now, are we feeding soy formula in our public school system?
Well, we're now allowing soy milk in the public school system.
Yeah, but Sally, how much do you have to actually drink to reach a level of toxicity? I mean, I can see in a prison population that is, you know, eating three meals a day that have a fairly large component of soy in, you know, in whatever products it is that they're feeding them, that could absolutely, just like anything else, could, you know, overbalance your metabolism. Whereas drinking a glass of soy milk, as opposed to drinking no milk or anything at all like that, I mean, there's got to be a balance here.
Well, soy milk has 45 milligrams of isoflavones per cup. And in the surveys of traditional diets, the amount of isoflavones in the Japanese diet, which is the highest soy diet in the world, was about 28 milligrams. Mm-hmm. So it's about double what's in the traditional diets, just in one cup of soy milk. And we know that when you get to about 30 milligrams a day in studies, you start to see thyroid problems and endocrine disruption. So one cup of soy milk is in the toxic range.
I believe it.
The health claim for heart disease that the FDA allowed is for 25 grams of soy protein, which is about 25 milligrams of isoflavones. So that's in line with the levels in the Japanese diet. These prisoners are getting 4 to 10 times as much.
Yeah, right. I mean, the prison is the prison, the food companies, they're all Blagojevich scumbags for not realizing and acting on this. They should have changed the next day. They should have tactical ability to change the diet.
Yeah, but
and
wait
Sally's
a minute.
Going to fight
Sally
very expensive
is clearly fighting the good
lawsuit,
fight.
But
I think that, you know, I mean, Sally, better than any of us, knows that she's up against not just the prison system, but the whole agro-industrial system where we actually subsidize the production of soy in this country for various reasons, including ethanol, but also expressly for food products
industrialized
food contracts.
I want to sign up for the opposite.
Well, I hope that people will support us in this soy fight. I mean, we're happy to get donations. This is costing us a huge amount of money. We're paying the legal fees. And you know, there's a huge amount at stake here. It's not just prisoners. And people say, well, they're, you know, dregs of society or whatever. But a lot of people who are in prison are innocent.
Blagojevich is the dredge of society.
Yeah.
Well, he'll be in there soon.
But my big concern is that they're now starting to do these high soy diets in pilot programs in schools. They're already doing this in Illinois. And these are innocent children. They are in their growth period. And when you disrupt the hormone levels during growth, you end up with things that can't be reversed.
Yeah, yes, and kids with you know, breasts when they're 6 years old and stuff. There's
a
bunch of weird stuff happening.
But that's
happening.
Also because of the hormones added to milk. The bovine growth hormone has
a huge impact. You know, I do want to tell you something about that. There was a study done in Puerto Rico where they had a kind of epidemic of early maturation in girls, and they expected to find a correlation with milk drinking. What they found was milk drinking had a negative correlation with this. They found the correlation with soy formula and eating chicken-fed soy. They did not find any correlation of early puberty with milk drinking.
Now tell us about your...
This was confinement, you know, totally regular dairy milk.
Uh-huh. Tell us about your raw milk cheese campaign.
Well, our campaign is for raw milk products in every form. This is, you know, the wonderful, healthy, perfect food that nature has provided. It's a food that even vegetarians can eat. It's a food that should be from grass-fed cows that supports small farms. We have a second website called realmilk.com where we address all of the myths and propaganda saying that raw milk is dangerous and that there's no benefit from it. This is absolutely not true.
Are you lobbying to
change? All the science together.
Are you lobbying to change the 60-day age limit?
That we have not focused on that. There's a lot of good cheese groups that are working on that. We are focusing on the state level just to make sure that people can get raw milk.
The reason that milk was pasteurized originally was because raw milk carried disease. Aren't you worried that some of those diseases will make their way back into the food chain?
Actually, the reason that milk was pasteurized, or the arguments for pasteurization, had to do with the very high death rate among children in inner cities, and they blamed it on the milk. This milk was produced in filthy conditions, and the main concern about the milk was it had no nutrition in it. It was confinement dairies in filth in the inner cities eating brewery swill. This problem was solved long before pasteurization became mandatory with the advent of refrigeration, with getting these dairies out of the cities, getting the cows back on the land. We had something called the Certified Raw Milk Movement, which made sure that the dairies were clean. And this kind of milk was accepted as being very healthy and very safe for many years. Around about the Second World War, the industry started a very malicious campaign against raw milk. It was full of lies and made up stories about epidemics caused by raw milk. The other concern was that you might get brucellosis or TB from raw milk. That was actually never proved, but it is moot today because our herds are brucellosis and TB free. We know how to produce clean raw milk. Raw milk has its own antimicrobial system in it. It actually kills pathogens, and it builds the immune system to be immune to pathogens.
But so, I know that the industrial milk, the industrialized dairy, industry feeds their cattle with the byproducts of distilling grains. Grain distilling.
Oh, I know. We've gone right back to the distillery dairies. We would never recommend industrial milk consumed raw.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. There's a threefold part to this. We call it a campaign for real milk. Real milk means it has all the fat in it, mm-hmm. because the fats are a very important part of the antimicrobial system. It comes from cows eating green grass on pasture, and it has not been pasteurized. So that's what we mean by real milk. We're not just campaigning for raw milk or grass-fed milk. We're campaigning for what we call real milk.
How are we going to make that kind of milk available to the general population?
People like me, distributors.
Well, it's more and more available in various ways in different states. It's a huge movement. We've gone from about 1% to 3% of the population drinking raw milk in the past few years. That's a very large increase. And I think it's where organics was 20 years ago, on the fringe, but poised to become mainstream very quickly. To specifically answer your question, in 8 states you can buy raw milk in stores. In about 28 states, you can buy raw milk directly from the farm, and we have about 10 states where you can get raw milk through herd share and cow share programs.
Well, I like, the Western Price Foundation, Heritage, actually really all sustainable food groups are always at a challenge to have the nutrition backing to all their claims. And I always say this because, here we are saying our foods are healthier. We just know they are. These are outdoor animals. And the Western Price Foundation gives us some teeth by saying that pasture-raised livestock get more vitamin E through their access to the sun. So by eating these fats.
And vitamin D.
Vitamin D from the sun. And so it's like, I think that somehow slow food and Western Price were aligned, coming to it from different, very different ways.
Exactly.
But
we're
they agree
much
on all
aligned.
The same things.
Yeah. Slow foods is looking at it from the cultural aspect.
Right.
The aesthetic aspect. We're looking at it from the health aspect, but the beauty of it is that those two things go together.
Absolutely. Mm. Well, we're very excited. Listen, you have got to come into the studio now. You've started intense debate, and you would love this place. They have plenty of fats on the menu,
good.
You will like it. You should come with all 4 kids.
Well, my kids are all grown up and living in different places now. But just for your listeners, if they want to go to our website, it's westonaprice.org. That's westonaprice.org.
And there's a place where people can ask questions, and there's an email there where if they have questions about their diets.
Yes, they can email info@westonaprice.org. We are just about to launch a brand new website that will have blogs and Yahoo, Facebook type of pages and so forth, and a lot more interaction. We're just getting the bugs out right now. So the current website has got lots and lots of information, but it's a little bit prehistoric, I have to say.
Well, you're just like the tribes that Weston studied. we are, this is the Q Report. It's Sunday. We are brought to you by Hearst Ranch. I'm Patrick Martins, broadcasting.
I'm Katie Kiefer.
Katie Kiefer, and we will come back in 2 minutes. That's 120 seconds with Ethan Gelber, who's
Thank
in the
you,
studio.
Thank you, Sally.
Thank you so much.
Great to have you on.
It was a pleasure.
Real honor. Wow, that was very, very interesting, I thought.
It certainly was. Thank you very much to Sally Fallon for joining us today. It is. There's a lot of information on both sides to review. I think everybody should make their own judgment about the issues surrounding soy. I certainly, personally, I would never eat three times a day any product,
right.
Whether it's, soy protein or any other protein.
Somehow the marketing around soy has been sexy enough that even in places like Bushwick, Brooklyn, there are dozens of people. When I used to get coffees for everyone here,
Roberta's, they want a soy latte.
Like 90% of them. And I just think that soy might not be, eaten the same way three times a day, but I do think you might have it in your coffee for lunch, then you'll have it in a salad for dinner, and, all of a sudden you've had it six times.
Maybe if you're a real soy... Well, I think the people who really are at risk, actually, are people like vegans who limit their diets so extremely
that
they end
else,
up using soy as a protein substitute. Now, that I can imagine being a real problem.
If nothing else comes from the Weston A. Price Foundation, that would be a big one. For all these young kids, who
grow up and think it's groovy to be vegetarian or vegan.
And vegan, and they realize that they, have to abide by health risks. And, as they get older, I think genetics can overcome any diet. But you're in the minority there. You just keep your fingers crossed. For the rest of the people, to be a vegan is not healthy. It just doesn't jive with the way we were built.
We are omnivorous creatures and always have been.
Just the way corn doesn't jive with the way a cow is built. It goes that deep.
It does. Well, I recommend the wonderful book by Richard Wrangham from Harvard University called Catching Fire, which is all about how cooking makes us human. And if we hadn't learned how to cook meat, we would never have developed the brain that we have. And the body that we have.
And I think, Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond. Well,
okay. Well,
if
anyway,
we do go buy any of these books, we will go by bicycle if Ethan Gelber has anything to say.
That's
or
right.
Am I making you too bike-centric?
Not too bike-centric, but I'm actually here to speak more generally about something called responsible travel. Not
so much
transportation as travel.
Is that
Ethan,
like
bring
eco?
Your microphone a little closer to your mouth so that people can really hear
Hello.
You well.
Is that eco-tourism? Is that the same?
No, choose your label. Eco, sustainable, responsible, ethical, conscientious,
Well, isn't
green.
There a difference between tourism and travel? Let's start with that.
Like I traveled here just now.
Yeah, you can split hairs. I think it is splitting hairs.
Oh, I don't. I think tourism is very distinct from travel.
I agree, but I think if you come back to the notion that you are leaving home and visiting another place, whether you do it as a tourist or a traveler, you're still leaving home and going to another place.
Okay, fair enough.
I'm looking very high level. We can get down into some of the deeper, into the deeper semantics, if you will. But for me, we'll go with the traditional. A traveler is someone who engages, a tourist is someone who goes to check something off the list. That's what a lot of people like to say. I'm fine with that. That's a good definition. But for me, whether or not you're a tourist or a traveler, there is a way to, if you want to look at it from the transportation perspective, there is a way to get to a place which is more appropriate in today's climate, in today's understanding of how the climate is changing. And then there's a way to behave once you are at the place.
So tell us, how should we get there and how should we behave?
And what if I've been behaving badly?
Oh, boy.
Oh. He's like, you disgust me, but I'm attracted to you.
If you've been behaving badly, you've got the perfect podium for telling the whole world about it right here.
Because they're definitely listening.
Well, what do you mean by, how you behave when you get there? Let's start with that.
And how to get there. I mean, so I'm at my house. I mean, let's give it in a day like me. I mean,
yeah,
I
let's
woke
do a
up,
day in the life.
I walked my dogs. I came back to the house, dropped them off, and I actually drove a car here. It's a Prius, parked. I'm going to drive back and then take my dogs back out. So, I mean, does your theories engage or encompass something as mundane and quotidian as that?
That's not the industry that I'm in, but sure, I'm happy to comment on that. You're doing the right thing in the ways that you can within the means that you have. I don't know how far away you live from the studio, and so the distance that you have to cover might be something more appropriate to vehicle transportation. If that's the means that you choose, within the time frames that you have, with the attentions of your dog before and after work, you might have to get home or you're left with a special gift. I don't know. There are lots of things.
The way you said that.
Is that an argument you make? Just really break it down, stop, look at it, and build efficiencies or minimize your environmental footprint as much as you can.
I'm not a scientist. I don't come at this from a scientific perspective. Mm-hmm. I live you live, each of us lives within a certain number of habits and a certain number of means, fit your responsible behavior into those means. As that responsible behavior takes over those means, you can then change the way you live mm-hmm. and change the way the people around you perceive how you live, and then change your community, your country, and then the world.
Not low on ambition here.
Well, why should we?
Why should we be? We're at the Heritage Radio Network.
Come strong or don't come at all. By the way, the sound effect boards is not working, guys. Jack, are you still in the back there?
Yeah, he is.
Look, I'm pushing.
He's pressing. Well, let's not interrupt Ethan here.
Let's not make a big thing about it, but you deserve applause.
Oh, I was going to do the Flintstones takeoff thing. I was going to be
well. We can applaud in our minds, and let's talk a little more about. So Ethan, tell us exactly what you guys get going in terms of how you help people make that transition to.
The you guys, let me define you guys first.
I mean,
first.
You guys being your organization.
Right,
yeah.
My organization is called the name is also the URL. The name is also the website. It's whl.travel.
Uh-huh. whl.travel.
Yes. And what does WHL stand for?
Yeah. WHL stands for itself now. It used to stand for World Hotel Link when the project was a World Bank project.
Did you say that in a court of law? You're like, it's standing by itself now. They're like, okay, it's officially yours.
No, no, no. The official company is still incorporated as World Hotel Link. But because of there are a variety of reasons, branding is an important thing these days.
Absolutely.
So since the company is a non-American company, everybody jumped up and down and said, yes, WHL, not really realizing that there's an important hockey league in North America. that's okay.
That's okay. Because it's WHL.travel.
.travel being a legitimate top-level domain. Mm-hmm. There are more and more. It's not just .com, .org, and .net anymore. It carries quite a bit further. So yes, WHL.travel. It's now the largest global online travel booking network in the world for people who are traveling off the beaten path and into... there we go. Sound effects are back. and into the developing world. Our focus there is, again, not so much on transportation and on the means by which you get there. It's saying... there are a limited number of means by which you can travel. Once you have traveled, there are proper ways to behave in a place. Proper being perhaps a heavy word, good ways to behave in the place. And those good ways of behavior include engaging with the local community in a much more intimate fashion than traditional tourism allows you to.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, it's basically breaking down the grammar of how to like sink in or see the secret place. I mean, that's what everyone wants. So what bit of headline advice do you give to people if they're going to a new place, like if I were to visit Uganda or something?
Well, it's about access. You arrive as a not to choose one brand over another, but you arrive as a classic Lonely Planet traveler with the book under your arm, and the book tells you where to stay, where to eat, gives you a little cultural background, a little historical background. But really, what do you know about the people and the place, and how to talk to a person who can help you get under the skin of the place? The truth is, not much.
Research about their cultural figures or, music they listen to.
And you can do that. You can go to a concert and go to the concert of the great local artist, and that's a great point of entree. Mm-hmm. That will get you in touch with people who really feel passionate about their home, and you can engage. A lot of people are more timid than that, who don't take the time to do the research via whatever tools they have, don't really engage once they're there, because mm-hmm. it's a terrifying thing for a lot of people to travel. You're completely out of your box. What we do as a network of local operators, we're the largest online community network of operators. We have about 300 people we cover 300 destinations in about 100 different countries.
Wow.
By booking through us, booking in the classic way that you would, use the internet to find hotels and tours and connectors mm-hmm. and connections and projects. By booking through us, you are necessarily engaging with a local tour operator who knows the destination, mm-hmm. is passionate about the destination, and knows that by coming through WHL.travel, you're interested in engaging in a way that others don't necessarily try to.
It's like the slow food model for people who start chapters or reviewers for the local osteria guide. They do an Italian osteria guide. I mean, and yet it's dedicated just to tourism, which is, if a family is going to travel for 2 weeks a year, you know, and they're going to spend all this money for this life-changing experience. I mean, you really want to make sure you do it right.
Well, you want it to be life-changing.
Yeah, and you don't want it to be...
instead of just sliding along the surface of any city or culture.
Which everybody does.
You want to go to the best person dedicated to that. You know, penetration of the society.
So the WHL.travel, so you guys, you link up with... in sort of on the ground, boots on the ground, tour operators
and the tour operators
people who specialize in understanding what their local scene is, so that you can integrate into that scene on some level, either by engaging through music. And I saw on your website or in your mission statement that you're now trying to integrate the food scene, because so many people are able to enter a culture through the food.
Well, think about the change in ethic. There was a discussion earlier about food and talking about there's the ethics and the kind of superficial quality of things, but then there's also the science behind it. We are coming at it from the slow food ethic, if you will, the slow travel ethic, which mm-hmm. is to say, instead of rushing to a place and then rushing through a place, travel slowly and with a perceptions open about how you get there. And then once you're there, the science then being, once you are there, how do you engage? What tours do you take, and how do those tours help you meet people and engage with people? And more to the kind of economics as a science subset, we're a company that allows you to, instead of spend most of your money up front to people who are not on the ground, most of the money that you spend remains with the people on the ground.
So you're especially with your work in developing countries, that's really huge. Kind of making a big impact on the local economies.
Enormous impact. Huh. In other words, the general numbers today are that $10 to $20 of $100 spent on travel goes to the people who are in the destination that you travel
to.
Wow,
so you promised that, wow.
And no, we promised the reverse. We promised that actually upwards of 95% of what you spend remains with the community to which you travel.
Wow, well, that's as big. I mean, if that is true, and I'm sure it is, I mean, that's what every American should be calling their going to this website. I mean,
so
that's amazing.
When you guys link up, when your organization creates a travel plan or a tour for, say I'm a tourist and I want to go to, I want to go to Italy. Is that one of the, it's not a developing country. Okay.
You sounded very excited.
Jack's going to Italy tomorrow.
We're not exclusive to the developing world or the emerging market world.
Give me an idea. Okay. So let's make this a little broader.
One question just before we get to that one, because it's going to lead into it. How do you choose your people? How do you know that you can trust them?
Yeah, that's a great question.
And then that'll lead into what Katie's
asking.
Into
letting me plan my trip.
You're like, could you just show me on your iPhone right now? Yeah. Just hit send. I'll give you a password.
We have an expression of interest process where we say we're going, we target a destination because it's an interesting destination. We go in and we work with, basically any players that we can. We do the research ahead of time to identify tour operators who may have already expressed an interest in sustainable travel or local development or have good connections.
How do you find that? Because I imagine just by knowing someone or finding someone, especially in some far out place, you'll just be so happy to know them, you know, and it might be very hard.
You won't know if they're the local shyster or the local
godsend. Well, not shyster, but just maybe the one that doesn't, you know, pay attention to the fact that a particular region might have a bee variety that makes a honey, you know, and that you really get into the interesting versus the touristy stuff, even though they mean well.
We work with tourist boards. We work with people on the ground. We work through the internet. There's a lot of information out there, good and bad. Somebody puts himself or herself forward or her organization forward and do a little bit of research. We communicate with people by Twitter, by Facebook. We use all the different means available to us to try to figure out if a place is appropriate. Mm-hmm. We vet as fully as we can. And then once we bring them on board, we have a certain number of KPIs, key performance indicators for how they should be behaving within the system. There's a contract that they sign. If they suck,
Katie and I be guinea pigs, and you send us out, and we'll just
I'll
they're
go pretty
good.
Much anywhere.
I wish we had testers, because I'd be doing a little bit more of that. 300 destinations
in
100 countries.
That
I don't get to go to all
of them. That into your prices.
No, but you mentioned that you work with the World Bank on this. So
is World Bank. It started as a project of the International Finance Corporation, the IFC, which is a part of the World Bank Group, as a project in the Mekong, only in Southeast Asia, working with local service providers, which is to say tour operators and hotels, to try and bring them into the global e-marketplace. In other words, mom-and-pop shops, little family-run hotels that have no access to the travelers who want to go to these places and today want to book ahead but can't. So the IFC and the World Bank financed a project to help put them together, and it was wildly successful. And this was rolled out to several islands in the South Pacific, and then now, and then the company went private and now has 300 destinations in 100 different countries.
You know what I'm hoping is, you know, Al Gore and his people, you know, I mean, who are really into this, you know, planetary view of things, basically just create a Zagat guide. I mean, that's, you know, you're creating the grammar for a true, single, acknowledged truth about a place when it comes to tourism. Because, you know, there is a right and wrong with culture. You know, they are the truly typical restaurants that can be traced back 400 years. And there might just be a very good restaurant, but doesn't necessarily have roots.
Or a really great street vendor on the corner of, you know.
The point is, there's enough variety on the ground. Well, the challenge is there's enough variety on the ground that actually pulling together a Zagat for each and every destination is an enormous task.
Yeah, I know.
What we're saying
it
is...
It would take forever.
You take a step back and say, well, what we can do is provide you with somebody who, within his world or her world, knows the five or six street vendors that he loves or the seven or eight shops that she loves. And when you arrive in this place, because this is a professional who's been involved in tourism and understands the nature of travel and the importance of bringing people together in an appropriate way, can point you to the places that, that they've uncovered.
Well,
it's not all places.
Ever,
it's not the right kind of bees necessarily, but perhaps it's the right farm stay or the right home stay or the right family doing the right thing in terms of spreading the wealth to orphanages or whatever it is.
Yeah. And it's a proprietary, of course. I was saying each person should send in where they take people, but then of course, you know, that little secret cafe might cease to be. But what does the business person ultimately want? I think most of them would want for that publication to come out, and it helps preserve their businesses.
Well, limited success. You know, the danger of something like Lonely Planet and the other guidebooks is that in many cases now it ruins a place.
The magic.
We're not saying that we want to do that. The nature of what we're doing, working with locals and working with them in their destination, they're the experts. They tell us how a place can develop sustainably, responsibly, ethically, in a green fashion, with an awareness of culture, with an awareness of the unique qualities of place. And we try to connect people who want to travel that way with the people who are helping people to travel that way. It's a service that hasn't existed prior, and it's a service that we think we're providing appropriately.
Well, very interesting.
I think
well,
it sounds
Ethan,
fantastic.
We would love maybe if you could come back, and maybe we could have call-ins from some of your various people, and they could just tell us how the most recent tour was, and if we as Americans are doing our job of not annoying the hell out of foreign populations. She's like, we had a real bad group from... People would be like, we got to behave. We could be on radio. They're going to talk about us.
Well, no, you know, fun and responsible don't have to be opposite on the opposite ends of the world. There is fun and responsible, but there is the core quality is, you know, laugh loudly, but laugh with the right kind of people.
Leave us with a couple of places, regions of the world that you think, because your business is strong there, people should start thinking about visiting.
Oh, boy. I'm looking at the list of 300 destinations and trying to decide.
What's a hot area of the world?
Oh, the whole world is hot, but there
we've got temperature wise.
We've got very good coverage down in Brazil. We've got 40 destinations either where their website's active or websites that are up.
Well,
and
that's
got
to be interesting to you, Patrick.
Oh, well, I'm wearing a Brazil shirt.
Yeah, wearing
just
a Brazil shirt,
and it doesn't have a name. This is old school shirt.
Oh, okay.
Back in the day.
We've got some 25 different destinations covered in Southeast Asia. That includes Vietnam, Laos, Thailand, Cambodia. You can reach out into the Philippines as well.
Uh-huh. How about India?
India, we've got about five or six different destinations. We're targeting that for you know, more general expansion.
And his website promises if you get your shoes stolen when you have to leave them outside by the temple, they will...
They'll
get
reimburse.
You a new pair within 6 hours.
No, we promise that if your shoes are stolen, then you're doing right by the local population.
Oh,
you're shodding a kid who has no shoes.
You're also getting calluses on your feet and all these weird...
There you go.
And you're supporting the local shoemakers.
So I would be having 2 to 3 pairs of flip-flops right in the back pocket. Jellies. I would have 4 pairs of my man jellies. Well, this has been very interesting. I hope you come back. We'd love to have some of your people on, and maybe even some of the people who've been on some of the tours, if they'd let us column and yeah, what they
I'd
thought.
Yeah, I'd love to get some personal, get a little yeah, some personal live report expertise. Card. That would be great.
You're going to have to down. Vet those very well.
We like to think that everybody who comes.
Yeah. I thought it was fun, but the scorpions in my shoes were really a drag.
I can't believe the tour guide. He never showed up.
Well, I was, the scorpion was the tour guide.
And I'm not eating monkey brains again.
Why do the doctors keep calling me patient zero?
I can see you guys are the right kind of travelers.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Oh, yeah, man. Put us up in front of the bus with the mic. We'd go on oh, 12 yeah. hours.
Oh, it would be bad.
I'm telling you, you'd have guests who'd never want to leave the bus. They'd never want to see anything. They just well, want to hear.
Within the first 10 minutes, there'd be those who would leave, and then the rest would stay.
The rest would yeah, stay, and right. we'd be like, we've locked the doors. So, well, thanks for coming on. We had a great show, Sally
great
Fallon.
Show.
I hope she comes.
With the Weston Price?
And I do think she's,
and
you know,
Ethan
I want to
Gelber
see
if from she is WHL.travel.
Truly... Yeah, okay.
Oh, my God. Okay, we're back. Oh, my God. It's the Q Report on Heritage Radio Network, sponsored by the Hearst Ranch. This is your host, Katie Kiefer, with Patrick Martins. We've had a great show. We had Ethan Gelber from WHL.travel. We had Sally Fallon from the Weston Price Foundation. And now it's time to do a shout-out to our number one folk singing gal, Mary Travers. May you rest in peace. Boy, that was, you know, that music still stirs my soul. I got to tell you. Absolutely. I grew up listening to that. I remember it from when I was a really little girl. I'm 53 years old, so Peter, Paul, and Mary was figured very large in my life at
when
a certain
point. When
did
you first, when were you at your peak of loving them?
I was probably 10.
Yeah?
9, 10, 11, 12. Yeah, all through. I remember going to the Newport Folk Festival where they performed.
Because you're from Rhode Island.
I'm from Rhode Island, yeah. And I was taken over there by my friend Sarah Campbell, mm-hmm. Who was my age, and her older brother John Campbell, who is a singer-songwriter to this day in Wakefield, Rhode Island. He's cut a couple of records.
Be the place where you come out and officially tell your mom, confess to her that you smoked your first joint when you were 9?
No, but I just got busted by my own kid.
Oh, my God. All right, back to the story.
Okay, never mind. That was too much information. No, I did not at that time, but I'm sure everybody else was. Since I was only about 10, I don't really remember. Was it 65, 66?
Because you
were
stoned.
I was a little girl. Yeah, contact high with the rest of the stoned hippies who were at this folk festival in Newport with Peter, Paul, and Mary. Joan Baez was there. You know, some of the great folk heroes of the time that had been coming up through the New York City club scene in the early 60s. And Peter, Paul, and Mary were there. And I will never forget, I mean, the entire... You know, folk festival, every man, woman, and child was up on their feet, singing along with them to this very song, If I Had a Hammer. It was incredibly
what
stirring.
What was she like
and it still
on stage?
Does it. You know, I read in her obituary this week, actually, that she was discouraged from speaking. It added to her mystique because she added the sex appeal to Peter, Paul, and Mary. I mean, uh-huh. I'm sure we all remember that Peter and Paul
were not so sexy.
Were not exactly sexy, but Mary was really cute. And she had that amazing set of pipes with the, you know, the beautiful bell-like tone of her voice.
Pipes? Is that a 60s word for something else?
For your
you
vocal
actually
cords.
Mean vocal pipes. Okay, just making sure.
And she just, you know, she rang out like the hammer of justice and the bell of freedom. And there's really, you know, there'll never be anybody like her. And she, as we all know, continued to perform well into, you know, her solo career after Peter, Paul, and Mary broke up, I think, in the late 70s. And then on and on. And still, I mean, even up until the last couple of years, I think, was still doing concerts, which were designed, as they were from the very beginning, to raise awareness of social justice. Yeah. And to bring people together around issues that should be catalyzing all of us to, you know, get out, vote, do our bit.
Their mission? I mean, what were they, anti-war?
Yeah, at the time they were very much anti-war and, you know, anti-establishment. But in a sort of milder way than subsequent groups that I think, you know, brought that message home more clearly, like the Jefferson Airplane or something like that, or the Grateful mm-hmm, Dead, which mm-hmm. were very much more sort of countercultural. The Folkies, I don't think, had the same sense of just, you know, tearing it all down, even though so many of their songs were about that. I mean, it wasn't just Peter, Paul, and Mary. I mean, there were lots of groups that were talking about tearing down the establishment and bringing in a new order. And, you know, Bob Dylan with Blowin' in the Wind. And
Black Panthers.
Yeah.
They no, weren't I'm singing about it, though. A bunch of people. Well, didn't they have a...
No, they didn't have a group. They just had Tom Wolfe.
Tom Wolfe.
But, you know, they were a powerful influence for people of my generation and a little bit older. And I think a lot of the reforms and a lot of the things that have happened and a lot of the way that we perceive the political world and the industrial world has much to do with the messages of folk singers of that era.
Guys, can we go out with the full song? Which song should we hear? If we're going to hear a whole song, which one do you think we should listen to? Katie, what's your personal favorite, most poignant?
If I Had a Hammer.
Yeah, that was really the quintessential anthem.
Way to get out of Googling anything.
Well, I mean, their other big hits were a lot more benign, like Puff the Magic Dragon.
Oh, no.
Or Leaving on a Jet Plane. I mean, I don't think so.
I can't tell you how many times I was at the Vassar, like, Poets Cafe with some girl playing Puff the Magic Dragon.
Yeah, no, yuck. Let's go with If I Had a Hammer.
And before we leave, bit of information, it's Noel Stuckey.
It was Noel Paul Stuckey. Thanks, yes. Jack, for looking that up
for
me.
Wow, this microphone is the best thing that's ever happened.
They made his name Paul because it sounded better with Peter, Paul, and Mary, because it was, think about the biblical implications of that, by the way, the apostles and the virgin. You know, just a little piece of subliminal messaging there. His first name was actually Noel Stuckey. So, and they met at the bitter end. They met on the club scene in downtown New York way back when.
God, what a cultural hotbed this is.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's the nexus of Western civilization.
You know, and I think Americans are very, very quick to forget that when America, you know, broke away from the English, you know, and was trying to sell itself as a real cultured country, you know, that was worth visiting and, you know, being a candidate for tourism, you know, they didn't have anyone who was a true native, you know, artist. And so throughout the 19th century, they were waiting for their first great violinist. You know, like, it has huge social implications. Like, when American wins the Tchaikovsky Award, you know, for cello or something, it is that we have... And back in the day, you know, we were waiting for our first poet, for instance, the first great American poet. And Walt Whitman ended up being it. And people didn't really know at the time until he was much older, you know. And if you really look back at these hallmarks of American civilization, they're so often within a 500-mile radius of Manhattan.
That's right.
You know, I mean, one after the other, all the old presidents or either ex-New York State governors or mayors, you know, it is a real...
Well, I've always felt that New York, you know, when they used to talk about the harmonic convergence, I don't know if anybody remembers when they, you know, we were planning for the harmonic convergence, and I always felt that New York was centered on one of those meridians. And I actually mm-hmm. think that both my friend Curtis and I have decided that Roberta's is centered on one of the meridians for the harmonic convergence because there's so much great energy here. So let's shout out to our friends at Roberta's Restaurant, 261 Moore Street and in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
And to Hearst Ranch for sponsoring the Q Report.
And for our amazing guests, Ethan Gelber at WHL.travel and Sally Fallon at the Westin Price. Thank you, boys. Jack Inslee, Bond Travels. Nat
and Mary Travers, best and rest in peace.
And Nat Wiener.
Brothers and sisters, oh.